The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. This episode is hosted by a very special guest, the new CEO of the Jazz Arts Group, Katie Coy. Katie sits down with the legendary Jeff Hamilton before the Jazz at the Lincoln concert, Swingin' in the New Year.
Hello, this is the Jazz Scene Podcast with Jazz Arts Group. My name is Katie Coy, and I am your special guest host today. I am the new CEO of Jazz Arts Group. And we have with us in the studio Jeff Hamilton, who will be performing this evening at our Jazz in the Lincoln series, Swingin' in the New Year. Hi, Jeff.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. Ready to wrap this year up.
Yes, I know. Can you believe? Well, Jeff, I'm relatively new to my role and am returning to Columbus after some time. And one of the things that I have learned since I got here is what a jazz legend you are in this town and how much we love it when you come to town. So I would love for you to just talk a little bit about how that started. When did you start coming to Columbus? What has your relationship with Jazz Arts Group been like over the years?
Well, I don't know that I remember the first time. It was probably on the Tommy Dorsey Band in 74, and we played in Elks Club someplace in Grove City or something, you know. Every band I was on, Woody Herman, Lionel Hampton, Count Basie, we would swing through Ohio. So I'm sure those were the first times I played in Columbus. The jazz club that I remember playing, a lot of your listeners may remember the Major Chord. When I joined Ray Brown's trio with Gene Harris on piano, Ray booked the Major Chord, and we had a nice couple of nights there.
Nice.
And then moved forward to my trio playing a place I can't remember, but Bob Breithaupt and Jim Rupp set it up for my trio in 94, and it was one of the first jobs I had with my trio. They were kind enough to help me get started. Then shortly after that, the Jazz Arts Group, I would come in when Byron would invite me, and it's always exciting and fun because Byron has something new up his sleeve to how to present.
Right.
It's not just the same Jeff Hamilton every time. It's a tribute to Buddy Rich one time, and then it's John Clayton and Benny Green another time. And so it's always fun for me to come in and see what he has on the plate for me. So I've been doing it for quite a while and always enjoy coming back to Columbus. And I've got a lot of friends in Columbus, family in Columbus. I'm from Richmond, Indiana, originally. So I know a few people here that it's always nice to visit. And great jazz fans. And this concert tonight is an organ trio, which, you know, it's steeped in history in Columbus.
Right.
I played with Hank Marr once, and it goes beyond that, but it's such a organist, jazz organist, such a history, has such a history here in Columbus.
Right. Does any particular gig or performance or story stand out about performing in Columbus over the years?
They all are about the same. It's a certain level that Byron reaches with the band whenever I've been a guest that you kind of expect that. Byron is such a great musician and leader and presenter of the music that he has his own standard that he has to reach for every show.
Right.
And I think it's up to the artist to meet that same expectation. And all the productions I've been involved in, he's had the right cast of characters to reach that level, and the audience gets it. So of course we love their support when we're playing, but we have to reach our own satisfaction level of what we're doing artistically as well to offer that to the audience. So it's just a nice giving and offering, and we get it back from the audience.
Yep, I hear you loud and clear on that. One of the things I would love for you to talk a little bit more about, you started to, is the difference between, or shed a little bit of light on leading a big band versus a combo. You said you've come through Columbus in a lot of different iterations of groups and performances. For folks who maybe are newer to listening to jazz or big band taking in some of these performances, talk a little bit about the differences or the similarities. What's your approach between the two?
Well, within each of those genres, a lot of people think the big bands sound one way. And it's, oh, let's go hear a big band. Well, it could be Glenn Miller music. It could be modern big bands, Maria Schneider. Mm-hmm. It can be the Count Basie Orchestra. It could be Maynard Ferguson. All those are different styles of big bands. So the same is true in trios. I played with Oscar Peterson. I played in Ray Brown's trio, Monte Alexander. Bill Evans is a different kind of trio than that. Brad Meldow. I mean, there are just so many different within the genre of small groups that you can't really say, okay, I'm going to go in and approach this as a trio drummer, and here's a big band gig tomorrow night, and I'm going to approach that as a big band gig. Yeah. It's all music that you have to know enough about to go in and treat the music as such, that you can bring what you know, your knowledge of the music, to that music to make everyone on the bandstand sound as good as they can. And so that's kind of what I live by, more so than there are five people in this group or there are seven sure. people in this group. I need to be aware of the setting, and they called me for a reason. So what can I contribute to this setting to make everybody sound as good as they possibly can, whether it's 17 people or holding together an orchestra for Lalo Schifrin at the Hollywood Bowl yep. with Ella Fitzgerald,
yeah.
or a trio setting in a club with 10 people in the club. You know, so it doesn't make a difference. That's the satisfaction level I talked about before, where you have to reach that no matter what the scene is, you know,
right.
whether it's a big band or a small group.
Right. Okay, so piggybacking on that, I was just in the master class that you gave downstairs. Mm-hmm. You had about 40, 50 students on stage, mm-hmm. and you were taking the deep dive into performing and life and everything young musicians like to think about and ask about.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you said that really struck me, because, you know, more often than not in these settings anymore, I'm an audience member.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking to one of the students about what he had just heard, and you said, "I took you with me, and I made you trust me," and that made the performance sort of take off. And I would love for you to talk a little bit more about that relationship with the audience, where you're asking for their trust, gaining their trust, and then taking them somewhere artistically. What is that like for you?
Well, I think, you know, like, it's us talking right now, and we just met.
Yeah.
And I'm trusting you and you're trusting me that we're going to guide this podcast the way that we both would like it to go. And it's working because we're both confident about what we do and what we can offer to this. And as a musician, being a drummer, as I mentioned in the workshop, if your beat is confident, you have that confidence to offer to everybody in the band. That goes to the audience. You're offering the music to the audience, not just the beat, but once the band is now all on the same page. But I don't mean stubborn drumming, dig your heels in and here's where it is. Just have a comfortable beat that everybody feels like tapping their toe to, and then that transcends to the audience, and everybody starts trusting everybody during the performance. Okay, they're not going to play anything that I hate. One of the rules of making a set list, Ray Brown turned over the set list to me when I was 23 with the LA 4. He said, "I like the pacing that you make a set list." And he said, "The only thing I would say is think of being in the audience and what would you want to hear next sitting in the audience. If you just heard a drum solo that was loud and fast, do you want another piece with a loud, fast drum solo
mm-hmm.
in the same key? In the same time signature, you know, mix it up." So I'm always keeping that in mind too. Like, don't get into a rut of, well, we're the band and we want to play our music and this is what we're going to play, whether, you know, you like it or not. I don't think that's a healthy way to present music to people and keep jazz interesting.
Right.
Not everybody is a hardcore jazz fan, so you can't go up and turn your back on the audience and just play your original music and expect to be able to be asked back to play. You know, I mean, there's certain venues that ask for that, but it's a small market.
Right.
So I think you have to keep everybody in mind. I'm not talking about dumbing down and playing Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree, you know, but if it's your statement
yeah.
on that, then it's okay. But don't become a wedding band, you know, when everybody's loaded at the end of the night
yeah.
just for the sake of the audience liking you.
Yeah. And that's something that you and Byron have in common. You know, I've heard him talk about that too. And it's very heartening, because I think one of the things that we, you know, face, are sort of wrestling with as arts managers is demystifying the experience a little bit for new audiences, mm-hmm. making sure jazz and concerts are a place that everyone feels like they know what they can expect. Mm-hmm. So I love the idea of building the set list with what would you want to hear next. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
And I think along with that, I think some of our audience, the younger it is, haven't experienced great quality in some of the music that they've grown up with, because it's, you press a button to get the drum beat.
Right.
And there aren't great harmonies in a lot of the music, and there aren't great melodies, and the lyrics are vulgar, and they're, you know, it's not endearing lyric that, you know, and there's a genre, there's a space for that genre. That's
right.
Okay. But I don't think that if you go to a concert, you have to kind of be open for what is going to happen and allow yourself to see the quality of music, whether you like or know anything about the genre at all. At least recognize, I mean, the first time I went to ballet, you know, it was like, man, what have I been missing out on? It's so athletic, yeah. It's so, I mean, but fragile, and the nuance, and I let myself really enjoy it instead of going, oh, it's going to be classical music for 2 hours,
right.
And then I'm going to be asleep after the second movement.
Right,
and,
you know,
and I really enjoyed that. I think audiences have to come in with less blinders on about if it's not. There's an audience participant in the last concert. I just played a drum solo, and I had just turned 70 years old right before that. And my niece said to the person next to them, "Can you believe that? I mean, even at 70." And the person went, "Eh." You know, so I think audiences have to come in and go, and I'm ready to hear some music, and it may not be in the genre I like, but
right.
I'm gonna like this because I can tell that these people have worked their butts off their whole life to
right.
do this, and it's hard to do.
It is hard to do.
Yeah
it's hard to ignore also. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. when audiences come in and they see something that is such a well-honed craft, that's well put together, that's thoughtful, that's dynamic. I think it's, you know, I had a previous boss who would say, it rearranges your molecules, you know? It's something that you can't.
I like that.
Yeah. And so I think if more people would just go into the concert hall with like, well, let's see.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I often tell my own story. I never went to a symphony performance until I was like 23 years old. I did not grow up going to live music concerts. But, you know, the more that you expose yourself to and the more that you work that muscle of listening to live music and hearing the craft involved, mm-hmm. the more you recognize it as time goes on. So mm-hmm. I'm with you on that. Let's see. You know, one of the things that stood out to me in your bio is that you are one of the rare people who, when you were a child, said, this is what I want to do. And you did it. And, you know, being a professional musician, we all know, is not something that comes easily to anyone. That takes a lot of work and sacrifice and all the things. So I would just love for you to talk about that. Like, what would you tell your childhood self about where you've ended up and what has the journey been like? Was there a hard right or a hard left somewhere along the way?
Yes, as a matter of fact, tomorrow is a hard right. You never know. Thank you for describing it as rare and not being an oddball at a young age, because I grew up in a musical family. My mother was a Baptist church organist and piano teacher. Both my older sisters were excellent musicians, pianists, and other instruments. My second sister, who will be here tonight, played alto saxophone and upright bass. So there was music in the house all the time from as early as I can remember. My father was a track star in high school and was drafted into Patton's Army in World War II. So being the fastest man in the infantry, he was laying the cable out in front so Patton could communicate.
Wow.
Right? Damned if you do, damned if you
don't,
right? Yeah. So what, I'm the fastest, you know?
Other duties as assigned.
Yeah. So big bands were popular, and there was a few big band recordings in the house. My mother would get booklets with the sacred music, so she could practice at home. The church helped her rent a small Hammond organ so she could practice at home with three kids. And in the back of the sacred music was a popular songbook with Take the A-Train, Satin Doll, Elmer's Tune, mm-hmm. Jada, all these mm-hmm. tunes from the time. And so at the end of her practicing, she'd have us gather around the organ, and we just would start saying, I guess I could hear at an early age too. I was the boy soprano in the group, and I learned the keyboard by laying on the floor, and she said, press that organ pedal four times, that's C.
Oh, wow.
Now count four up and that's F. That's how I learned the keyboard.
Wow.
So it was always around our house, and I grew to love the big band music. My sisters were starting to, a little older than me, and they were listening to Bill Haley and Elvis, and I never really was attracted too much to that music. Too many electric guitars and amps, and I grew up with acoustic big bands and Oscar Peterson Trio, and that was what I kind of gravitated towards. And I never was a product of my generation. I got along with friends in high school. I mean, I was, you know, wasn't an oddball like I said before, but I knew musically that I was different than anybody else. When I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show, I was 12, and I thought. But I've been listening to Buddy Rich and Papa Joe Jones and the Basie Band and Gene Krupa. And to me, that drumming is unbelievable. And this is okay, but that music has more interesting chord progressions than I want to hold your hey, yeah, yeah, and, you know. And so I just kind of was kept staying where I was and then playing to the records and realizing I think I can play with some of these people. So I got serious and taking private drum lessons, private piano lessons, and making a list of who I wanted to play with and setting that as goals. And I ended up playing with everyone that I wanted to play with. But it was a lot of homework, you know, and dedication to what you want to do.
Yeah.
But it was all worth it, your first night on the bandstand.
And you said there's a hard right or a hard left tomorrow. What's that?
Well, getting on an airplane is the hardest part of this business. You know, the great alto saxophonist Phil Woods always said, I get paid to travel. I play music for free.
Right? Yeah.
So that's the hard turn tomorrow. Yep, you know, just having to deal with an airport again.
I know it.
And then I travel with drums still a lot. I keep a set of drums here in the Midwest, but a lot of times I'm flying with drums, so, you know, multiply that by the headache of no sky caps anymore at your arrival place,
right,
and trying to get the drums to where you're supposed to play. And
so so the logistics of flying with drums, I'm not aware of. Do you buy them a seat?
No, they're in hard cases, and everything's under 50 pounds.
Okay.
And you try to fly Southwest because it's now it's up from 75 a bag after the first two bags. It's 125 a bag.
Woo.
So, you know, they just keep throwing right-hand curves and left curves at you. So that's what all the airport madness is for me.
Yeah, I know. There was over the holidays we traveled and I encountered there's like an economy class and then like economy plus.
Uh-huh.
They've like divided it all up now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen.
For about 4 more inches legroom.
That's right. Yeah. Listen. Yeah.
And $400.
Isn't it amazing? The zigs and zags they're finding to build into that experience.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. I also want to talk a little bit. Okay, this is my one selfish question on this podcast because Ella Fitzgerald is one of my muses. I've always adored her. Long before I was now working in jazz, I wish I could somehow tell my younger self that I was getting closer to Ella as the years went on, or at least I feel that way. You played with her.
Right.
I would love to hear about that time.
Yeah, I spent a year with her. It was through Norman Granz, who's a huge jazz promoter from the days of jazz at the Philharmonic, which we did a tribute to with Byron one year. And he managed Ella and Oscar Peterson. So he was responsible for recommending me to Oscar and Ray Brown was as well, because I'd played with Ray for 18 years. And so Norman called me for the Ella Fitzgerald job, and I was with her for one year in the mid-80s. And she was as adorable, dare I say, a bit naive sometimes about, she just seemed like an innocent 15-year-old girl who was just so lovely to be around and was unaware of how great she was until she hit the stage, and it was just natural. She wasn't trying to impress anybody. It was, I hope I can do this sort of thing when she hit the stage. I had done homework, as I mentioned before, on everybody I wanted to play with. I had not done as much on Ella because I'd played with a lot of singers by that time Torme and Tony Bennett, and I mean, not just singers, but
sure,
you know.
Sure.
So I was moving away from playing with vocalists a lot by that point. Mm-hmm. And then I got the call for Ella. So most of the records I had were the trios with her, or dare I say behind her, mm-hmm. were more subtle. And all of the singers I'd played with wanted the drums to be more subtle. Mm-hmm. And so I went into that gig with that way of thinking, and after the first tune, this sweet lady turns around to me while the applause is going after the first tune, and she says, gently, she says, "Go ahead and give it to me, honey." And I said, okay. And I went right to the recordings of Gus Johnson, the great Basie drummer, playing with her, and he was having at it at the drums. That's and I amazing. Just dug in, and she turned around and winked at me on the next tune, like there it is.
There it is.
At the end of the hair standing up on the back of my neck as I'm telling this story. At the end of the concert, we're taking a bow, and we offer her first off stage. And I'm the first one to come in contact with her off stage. And she had stopped and turned around. And I thought, what's she going to say? And she said, "Was I okay tonight, honey?" And I said, "You're Ella Fitzgerald. Are you kidding? It was wonderful." She says, "Oh, okay, well, I hope so." And that kind of sizes up to me her personality.
Yep.
Just so sweet and unassuming.
That word was in my head.
Just natural, but could bring it. I mean, Ray Brown told me that people would, and Oscar did too, that a jazz is the Philharmonic, when they would bring her out to scat sing, and you've got great soloists at Jazz is Philharmonic, mm-hmm. legendary players, and some of them would put their horns under their coats and back off. They didn't want any part of trading with Ella, you know? I mean, she was that great.
Wow.
And to me, the greatest scat singer of all time.
Yeah. Well, that story just made me.
Now, are you
more.
Happy?
Yes.
Well, I just made all that stuff.
Don't tell me. Don't tell any of us. We're all gonna put it in our pocket and take it with us. I just think she's so remarkable and unassuming. And
she was indeed.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Love it. What are you excited about for tonight?
That I'm able to make the gig.
I know. That wasn't a given this time around, right?
Yeah. It's a privilege to be able to hit the bandstand and do what we love to do.
Yeah.
Diana Krall and I had a long conversation about this because I first met her when she came to a jazz camp to study with me. And that was our first meeting. And we talked about, you know, I have to go play. And I said, no, you get to go play. Yeah. You know, we get to play this music. And she's retained that, you know, that way of thinking through the years, that it's an honor and a privilege to set foot on the bandstand and be allowed to play what you're passionate about with people that you love to play with. Tonight is really different because the guitarist I've never met before today at 11 o'clock I met him. He's played with Akiko somewhat in New York.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Charlie Sigler, and he came in and owned it. He'd done his homework on the music that we're playing, made it so comfortable to play. And that's the beauty of this music, is that as long as you have the common language of the history of the music, which I would also go back and ask the audiences to kind of do a little homework on. If you're going to go hear a certain artist with the jazz arts group, do some homework on them.
Yeah.
You know, find out where they came from, and
sure.
It'll make the experience more interesting. So Charlie's definitely done his homework on the people he's playing with on the stage tonight. So it's exciting to get to play this music, and we'll, Akiko and I will be playing arrangements we've been playing for 10 years. And Charlie knows most of them, I think. Well, we'll find out tonight. But that's what's so fun about jazz, is that we're not sure what's going to happen, but we are sure it's going to be a great performance.
That's right.
But we can't predict. That's why a lot of promoters want a set list of what you're going to play. Well, I don't know, you know, because I might be in the audience, and after I just heard that tune we played, I don't want to hear what I got programmed
next.
So we need to make a right turn for the audience.
Yeah.
And maybe get them a little more involved in what we're going to do. So And Akiko is so great to play with, and so I'm happy that I get to do what I get to do, you know, for a living, and have been able to do this for this long.
And I love seeing, and I've seen it often in my time with Jazz Arts Group and beyond, the principles of jazz just inform life. You know, this idea of improvisation. Mm. You know, there's no wrong notes. Mm. It's just what you do next, mm-hmm. where you take it next. So,
right. Yeah. With knowledge, there are no wrong notes.
There you go.
You got to know how to make the wrong notes right by playing the next right note.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Sure.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
It's
me
been
too.
Good to get to know you.
Yep, me as well.
As we close, I would love to just ask you one final question. One of the things that strikes me about Columbus, that I love about Columbus, is how many passionate, young, artistic people or arts-adjacent people there are in this town. And I know that there's a number of towns like Columbus out there. And so I would love to close by just hearing from you maybe a piece of advice, a word of encouragement or caution or wisdom around those who are just starting off making their lives in the arts. What would you say to them?
First of all, if you want to do this for a living, don't let anyone tell you you can't. The Midwest historically has been, in my experience, take the safe route. You know, stay in a town you grow up in. Be careful, you know, in your occupation selection, you know. And I always had the confidence that I could be a jazz drummer. There were two other jazz drummers from my hometown that were successful, Joe Hunt, who played with Astro Gilberto, and Gary Burton and Stan Getz. He's on famous recordings. He taught at Berkeley for 35 years. Mm-hmm. And there was a trio in Richmond that all of us went through. It was like this stepping stone for us to get to hone our craft. Harold Jones was the second one, who's also been a guest of the Jazz Arts Group. He was in high school with my older sister. Mm-hmm. And he was on the Count Basie Orchestra, Sarah Vaughan, and many, many others. Tony Bennett's last drummer. And so I had these two people as role models. Andy Simpkins, a bass player with Sarah Vaughan, is from my hometown. George Shearing, he played with George Shearing. So it's like, I can play with these. I can do this. But everybody wants to be me the band director, you know.
Yeah.
And I could do that too, and I liked it, but I wanted to play with Oscar Peterson, you know, et cetera.
Right.
So I wasn't defiant. I just was confident quietly that I could do it. And then you get the little successes along the way of first chair in the band and then all-state orchestra or band, and then you make a band in college, and now they want you to be be the leader of the band and so forth. And then word of mouth gets you on a big band, name band, which is really what happened. And then each band hears about you on the road. So I only spent 9 months on the Tommy Dorsey band before Lionel Hampton hired me for 3 months.
Wow.
Then Monty Alexander hired me for 2 years. And then Ray Brown heard me with Monty Alexander. Yeah. The trombone player on Tommy Dorsey's band was then on Woody Herman's band and asked me to come on Woody Herman's band. I stayed for 6 months, then Ray Brown hired me away from that. So that, I mean, that's the way it sounds like I couldn't keep a job, but it just happened so quickly of everybody I wanted to play with. Well, it started because I was serious about it, knowledgeable about it, done a ton of homework. And I said in the clinic that you heard today, when you do have that opportunity, I hate the term lucky, you know, were just lucky.
Me
you were
too.
At the right place at
yes.
the right time. No,
no.
I did my homework, and when the opportunity was presented to me, I was able to seize the opportunity, and fortunate
That's
that
right.
I had done all my homework to get ready for that. So I forget what the original question was on this,
no,
but boy,
this
did I
good.
Go off, you know.
Luck is hard work in disguise.
Yeah, yeah right.
Yeah.
Luck is in Vegas when you pull the one-armed bandit, you know. I would advise them to believe in yourself, but don't fool yourself. You've got to put in the work.
Right.
Don't think that it comes easy. Don't think you're better than you are.
Yeah.
You have to be honest with yourself and your talent and assess that at the time, whether you can go ahead and do it, or is it just, I want to do this,
right.
you know? So you got to be realistic about it. But I always had the confidence that I could do it. And then when I dropped out of school at Indiana University, my parents were just concerned, but they said, so what do you think? And I said, let me make you a deal. Give me 5 years to play with one of the people on the list that I made. And if I don't do that, then I'll go back and finish school, I'll get a master's degree, and I'll be the band director. I said, okay. And 8 months later, I got the call to go to Tommy Dorsey Band. So it's like, that's my boy up there on the bandstand.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, and you had to pay $20 to hear me tonight, didn't you? Lovingly.
Love it. Of course. Of course. Oh, gosh. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for your stories
thank
and
you.
your musicianship. I'm so looking forward to tonight.
Great. Thank you. So am I. And continued success in your new role.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Swingin' in the New Year will be available to watch at JAG.TV on January 12th. That's JAG.TV. The Jazz Scene is presented by Jazz Arts Group of Columbus, America's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the art of jazz. Our theme music is titled 3/4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was hosted by Katie Coy and produced and engineered by Mercedes Aviles. Subscribe to The Jazz Scene wherever you get your podcasts.